I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Thank you so much, Claire. I'm a bit worried because I don't think we're going to be able to take it to a more informal level. Because we're going to be quite informal,
yes.
Don't you think?
Yes, I think we are, of course.
I think we should be. We've just been... Anyway, no, we've just... We've just been talking about lipstick.
How to put lipstick on with a mobile phone, which I didn't know. But now we're both feeling a bit lipstick.
We're feeling quite lipsticky now. So should we get into the serious, you know, literary head business before we, you know, turn into loose women or something like that up here? Nothing wrong with loose women. Tessa, I'm so thrilled to be doing this. I love, love, love this book. Will you start by reading us a little? I think... I boringly said, well, the opening is pretty good, but it is a bombshell opening, isn't it?
It's funny, when you have a new book and you start taking it round, you don't know which bits you'll read and which bits will fall into place. And this one, the opening is sort of irresistible because it starts with a very big thing happening. But I am finding there are some bits inside the book that I can take out and read as well, but it's... nice to read this. So this is the very beginning. You need no explanation as to who anybody is or where we are or what's happening. They were listening to music when the telephone rang. It was a summer evening, 9 o'clock. They had finished supper and Christine was listening with intensity, sitting with her feet tucked under her in the armchair. She recognised the music, although she didn't know what it was. Alex had chosen it. He hadn't consulted her, and now she stubbornly wouldn't ask. He took too much pleasure in knowing what she didn't know. He lay on the sofa in the bay window with a book open in his hand, not reading it. The book dropped across his chest. He was watching the sky outside. Their flat was on the first floor, and the sitting room window looked out over a wide street lined with plane trees. A gang of parakeets zipped across from the park, and the purple-brown darkness of the copper beach next door fumed against the turquoise sky, swallowing the last light. A blackbird, silhouetted with open beak on a branch, must be singing, but the recorded music overrode it. It was the landline ringing. Christine was dragged away from the music. She stood up and looked around her to see where they'd put the handset down when they last finished with it. Probably somewhere here among the piles of books and papers, or in the kitchen with the washing up. Alex ignored the ringing, or only showed he was aware of it by a little irritable tension in his face, always liquidly expressive, foreign because the eyes were so dark, outlined as if they were painted. This effect was more striking as he was growing older, and brightness was leaching out of his hair, which used to be the colour of tarnished dark gold. It was more likely to be her mother on the phone than his. Or it might be their daughter Isabel, and Christine wanted to talk to her. Giving up on the handset, not bothering to fish in her bare feet for her espadrilles, she hurried up the stairs, taking them two at a time, she could still do it, to where the phone extension was in their bedroom in the attic. The music carried on without her in the room behind, Schubert or something. And as Christine dropped onto the side of the bed and answered the phone breathlessly, she was aware of the sweetness of a tumbling succession of descending notes. This room they had made under the sharp angles of the roof held in all the heat of the day and was thick with smells. Traffic fumes, honeysuckle from the garden below, dusty carpet, books, her perfume and face cream, the faint body staleness of their sheets. The prints and photographs and drawings on the walls, her own work, some of it, had sunk into the shadows, obliterated, and only the pattern of their framed shapes showed against the white paint. Through the open skylight, she could hear the blackbird now. Sweetness. Yes? There was some confusion of noises at the other end of the line, as if the call was coming from a public place, like a station where it was difficult to speak. Intently, someone was asking for her. Can you hear me? Is it you, Lyd? Christine felt herself smiling, pleasantly sociable, even though she couldn't be seen, sitting on the low bed with her knees pressed together. She thought that Lydia must have been drinking, which wasn't unheard of. Her voice was heavy, slurring as if something in it had come loose. What are you up to? I'm at the hospital, Lydia shouted. Something's happened. What's happened? It's Zachary. He was taken ill at work. The room quaked and its stillness adjusted. A few dust motes came spiralling down from the ceiling. Unheard of for anything to harm Zachary. He was a rock. He was never ill. No, nothing so numb as a rock, a striding, cheerful giant with torrents of energy. Christine said she would call a cab at once, be with Lydia in half an hour at the most. Which hospital, which ward should I come to? What's the matter with him? It's his heart. He's had a heart attack? They don't know really, Lydia said, but they think it's his heart. One minute, apparently, he was in the office at the gallery, perfectly fine, talking to Jane Ogden about a new show. The next minute, he keeled over, hit the desk, everything went flying. Maybe he hit his head when he hit the desk. And what's happening now? Are they going to operate? Why aren't you listening, Christine? I told you, he's dead. On her way to tell Alex, Christine paused outside the open door of her studio where the shapes of her work waited faithfully for her in the dusk. Bottles of ink, twisted tubes of paint, the Chinese porcelain pot with her pens and brushes, the pinboard stuck with postcards and pictures torn from magazines, feathers, stained cloth, scraps of weathered plastic. Creamy sheets of thick paper laid out on her desk waited for her mark. Primed canvases were stacked against the wall. Pieces in progress were on the easel or pinned onto boards. She came to this scene of her labours each morning like coming to a religious observance, performing little rituals she had never mentioned to anyone. Her strongest desire these days was to be at work in there, standing up at the easel or head and shoulders bowed over the paper on her desk in concentration, absorbed in her imitation of forms, her inventions. But now, the idea of this work, the fixed point by which she steered, was sickening. It seemed fraudulent, the sticky project of her own vanity. She closed the door on it quickly. Then she opened it again. There was a key in the lock which she turned sometimes when she didn't want to be interrupted. She took out this key and locked the studio from the outside, put the key in her jeans pocket. The music was still playing in the front room. Was it your mother? Alex asked. Her heart lunged in thick beats in her chest. She didn't know if she could speak.
Thank you so much. I wanted to ask you first, what it's like when you begin a novel with your four principal characters there or not there.
I'm not there.
One at the end of the phone, another dead, but still on the page in front of us. And they really remain your four characters, despite other interventions and other people making their way through the narrative. But just to start that boldly with those four people, what's that like?
I did start with them. I mean, that is the first words. Most of those words are as I wrote them, first time, so to speak. I did originally, before I began writing the novel at all, when it was in my head and in my notebooks, I didn't know for a while that I was going to start with that, or to reel back a little bit. For a long time, I wanted to write about these two marriages, these two couples, twined together in various combinations through the decades. And first of all, I thought I would write about them chronologically. Then I thought that the strongest, biggest thing I could make happen to my four was to reduce them to three at a cruel stroke. And as soon as I knew I was going to do that, I knew I couldn't do that three quarters of the way through the book. No. It would have been gratuitous, cruel to the reader, a trick in a way, and somehow wouldn't actually have the momentousness that it has coming at the beginning. Mm. So that scene, as soon as I knew he was going to die and then knew that the book needed to begin with that, the scene was in me. I had it. I had a picture of it in the place. And I suppose I was aware in an almost theatrical way, as you began with, Alex, of mustering my four characters and beginning with them as I mean to go on. Although actually the novel ends with no spoilers or anything, but it sort of ends more solitary, actually.
That idea of it coming to you and that tableau, you've said before talking about your work that it often starts with something very visual, sometimes even a scene from a film from or a something film. Like that.
And weirdly, I did have a scene from a film here, although when I say what film it was, I can't even think of what the connection is. What I thought of is a very bleak film, was that marvellous Michael Haneke film, Amour, which does begin in an elegant French flat where the lovely elderly couple are coming back from a concert. She's a concert pianist, and it's where she begins to have the first sight of her dementia. I mean, it's an absolutely unbearable, brilliant film. But I did have that. But what? I don't know quite how that connects to it, but the emotional timbre or something of the film was useful to me.
Well, there is something to do with settled lives about to be disrupted.
Yeah. In a place that feels like a well-lived-in place, furnished with their stuff, with the history of the time in that flat together, and then it's about to be all disrupted.
All thrown up in the air. But I suppose what also comes out of that idea of that settled space, I mean, everything's got to happen somewhere, hasn't it? But that idea of a domestic interior is that your characters have relied so much in various ways, as we all do, on those kind of props of living and the things that they say about them, the things that they mean to them. Mm. And that's a very kind of complicated canvas to work on, isn't it? Because in fact, they're also quite alienated from them. Mm. Just tell us a little bit about these four people and their kind of almost Shakespearean history in a way. I mean, that sort of comically Shakespearean.
Yes, yes. In the sense of lots of swapping around. Mm. I mean, so that once I had decided to begin, as it were, with the death of Zachary in the present, I mean, it's roughly contemporary with where we are, except that Trump and Brexit haven't happened. I think of it as set in 2015. So I thought what I would do structurally is run that present story of what becomes of the three remaining when this one of the quartet is at a stroke taken from them. All the intricate, painful things that ensue between the three that are left. That's one level of my story. But three times I dip down into the past. First of all, the four of them in their 20s. And what we discover there, sort of, with, I hope, lots of comic potential to relieve the sadness of the primary story, in a way, is that at first it was... In the present moment, we have Lydia as the new widow of Zachary and Christine married to Alex. Then we discover, first of all, Alex is married to somebody else, and it's Lydia who is obsessed with him. She's been taught by him at university, and she's fixated on him, and she contrives a sort of babysitting scene where she really is, they are the babysitters from hell, and they go snooping through the house. And she said, I've got to find out what their marriage is like. Are they sleeping together? It doesn't feel good to me. Sort of trying to get in there and get hold of Alex, but then failing, and she ends up with Zachary, and Christine ends up with Alex. And I sort of just, that's not much of a spoiler, because that's all early on. And then I just ring the changes in a way, and I go on playing with my two couples.
It did feel like a very playful novel to me. And it also felt, and I know I'm not by any means the only person to have noted this, and I don't know whether it annoys you or not, because we haven't discussed it. But this idea of it being a kind of reworking of the Hampstead novel, the idea that it takes place in this zone of kind of privilege and people talking about music and the arts and politics and worrying over there. I mean, there's a scene with a frittata. That's what I'm... Like, there's a crisis.
Is a frittata one of those things? I think a frittata's quite a relatively straightforward old-fashioned thing. They're not cooking an ottolenghi dish.
True. It is 2015, you're right. They're not going, no. But she makes a frittata. She doesn't open a tin of beans.
She doesn't open a tin of beans. It's true. I mean, the Hampstead thing, it only a little bit of it is set in the past, in old Hampstead, which is where Christine grew up, when ordinary people lived there. Nobody lives in Hampstead now. I don't mean in reality, I mean in my book. But, and they're not, I mean, Christine and Alex live on a schoolmaster's salary. They're actually quite hard up, but of course that doesn't prevent one from watching Tarkovsky films and reading poetry. I don't know why I'm just interested in people like that, alongside all the other people. That's what they're like.
Yeah.
It's probably somewhat familiar to me. I like Tarkovsky films.
It was interesting, though, and I know it's very vexed and vexing to talk about likability in characters, but when I started reading this book, and I was automatically at home in your sentences because they're by you, and I, you know, feel like I know, I feel comfortable and safe and know that I'm in for a treat. But a little way, and I thought, these people are awful. I cannot, oh my God, what has she done? They're awful. I mean, they're not really awful, but they are a bit, aren't they? They are a bit.
I like them all. But that's the business of the writer, is to have room for them all. And they don't strike, they're none of them running hedge funds or exploiting the workers.
No.
Or bullying each other. They're problematic. They're all flawed, ordinary people, like human beings are. They don't behave brilliantly. But, I'm disappointed that you don't like any of them.
Well, actually, Zachary's one, but he's dead. And that changed.
Yeah.
But certainly, I think you do get this. You do get a gender divide fairly early on, not, as I say, between the kind of very exuberant, generous, loving Zachary, who's been removed, as we know from the picture, on, you know, straight at the beginning. But certainly, I think as a woman, you develop a kind of distrust of this character, Alex, who is a purist. He's politically pure. He's artistically pure. He is emotionally withheld. And we learn, partway through the book, again, I hope not a spoiler, not immensely supportive of his wife's creative life.
But that's true, and all of that is true, and it's part of my portrait, and I'm interested in that. And I'm interested in how the things that one might like about Alex, that he is truthful, that he doesn't try to please very much, are also the things one might not like about him. It's true, and it's a problem in the book. It's put in there to be something serious, that he probably doesn't like his wife's art very much, but you can't command your liking. You can't decide that it would be nice to like your wife's art, therefore you will. So if you don't, you don't.
But there is there not also the sense that he just doesn't quite take her whole idea of being an artist sort of seriously? Is that fair?
Yeah. So that's just a thing in him.
Yes.
And there it is in the book alongside all the other things about all the other people. And I hope that the book doesn't, or any book that's any good, doesn't go around sort of skewering people on judgment skewers. It sort of says there's a whole cluster of possible judgments circling around this man and this woman and what they say and what they are and what they do. And they're all in play, but there's no last word.
Yeah.
That's how I kind of feel that writing when it's open and truthful works, because that's sort of how I really perceive judgment works at its best.
And it life.
And life. That it doesn't close down finally. I mean, obviously there are some people and some acts that it needs to close down on finally and firmly, but mostly where people are doing their best to get by, to live largely and imaginatively, then there needs to be lots of space around themselves and their acts.
Can I ask you about Christine, who is our focus, really? I mean, she is, yeah, in a sense, our kind of central...
There's a lot more written from her perspective.
Yes, yeah. And we kind of go through the whole thing more from her point of view, I think, than anyone else's.
We do.
And the fact that she is an artist and that you picture her almost sort of closing up her studio and for some reason that you don't, you know, purposely don't articulate precisely... unable to return to it. Not, I think, we believe, not simply as a matter of being grief-struck, but somehow she separated from her art. I was terribly interested in that portrayal.
I think it's... I mean, it is just that little bit I just read. It happens right at the beginning of the book, that it's obviously the centre of her life in her 50s, whatever her marriage is. And, you know, there are things, if you like, to critique about Christine inside that marriage as well as about Alex. Whatever her marriage is, something has shifted and the centre of things for her is in that room doing that work. And then this death comes, this death of a close and intimate loved friend, and somehow makes it impossible. What's happening there? And trying to explain that, it's the relations between somebody's work and their private emotional life are always... indirect and complicated. And I think there are probably a number of things that could happen to anyone who worked painting, making films, writing. There are things that could happen in your private life which simply severed the place from which creativity comes and made it seem not only inaccessible but actually grotesque. And that's sort of what... that's a very interesting thing, the whole relations between the making work of art and the living work of life and how they work together, and that there are things from the life side, if you like, which could just crush, at least provisionally.
It does... That sort of view, which you... It's so skillful in the book because you don't actually... portray her having constant sort of wrestling matches with herself about it. It's just there, almost like a sort of black hole, that studio.
As soon as I give her that key, I've got a very useful thing that I can bring up from time to time. She sort of moves it from her pocket to her handbag, and then at some point she can't even quite remember, but she's put it into a pot in the kitchen.
It's really...
It's the key. That's all I need to do is
just have it.
I do
it
a
there.
Bit more than that, obviously. But
have it there.
Yeah, have it there.
Almost just flickering on the edges of our...
Yes, because this problem that has arisen for her work is not something that can be resolved by thought or let's try and, you know, sort out what's going on here. That isn't going to solve it. Who knows what mysterious thing will solve it eventually.
But it is interesting, isn't it, as I read it, that she is... the female artist, not entirely kind of licensed by her husband's approval. She has had other roles in her life, many of them. And that idea that the creativity is not something that actually puts her up on a pedestal where grief or loss or disharmony just knocks her off. It can just go like that.
Yeah.
She makes less of a case for herself as an artist in a way.
That's all absolutely right, but the book is not a protest about that.
No,
I think the book feels as if that's as it should be. And I don't know that I can imagine the woman who would have gone back in the next day and thought, oh, let's make a painting about Zachary's death. I can imagine her perhaps, but this seems to me to have some right respect in it. And I don't even mean just respect for Zachary, actually, who after all doesn't care. I sort of mean respect for the work, funnily enough.
As we're kind of talking, it's sort of putting me in mind of so many of your other books where you, all sorts of things come up, all sorts of things about motherhood, marriage, childbirth, infidelity, politics, sexual politics, larger scale politics, as it were. But you absolutely refuse or choose not to name them, to have them centre stage in a kind of any sort of polemical way. As you just said, this book is not a protest about that.
Yeah, protesting doesn't ever seem to me a very interesting tone. It seems two-dimensional or one-dimensional. It's like this judgment thing, isn't it? It's like the difference between skewering things and then you've got a dead thing on a skewer. Instead, let all your thought circulate watching and seeing things from different angles. That seems, I'm not making here so much of a moral judgment as an aesthetic judgment, that it just seems more beautiful and larger to keep everything open rather than make it something into an issue or a protest.
But it's very skillful to be able to have these books which are intensely character-led. I mean, it's a stupid thing to say, really, what novel is not character-led, but the ins and outs, their moments of their consciousness, the fluctuations in their subjectivity, their surroundings, they're all terribly delicate and changeable, aren't they? And seeing your characters exist in the time, in the scope of a novel, seems to be often your kind of primary aim. Does that feel fair?
Yeah. Yes, it does. Sort of what I want, what I feel hungry to do is to somehow dip into the present moment that we inhabit and catch enough of it and catch enough detail to put it on a page. How did we live then, as it were, except when it's now, but
how did it then, once you've written about it.
Yes, once you've written about it, what was it like for those people, those sort of people, to live in that sort of way at that moment? And yet that is full of ideas, partly because they're thinking people, but it's not just that, it's because they are themselves part of politics and history and a conflicted culture. So all of that stuff is arising in the way one tells the story. Mm. Like stuff about, there's some line where I say, both Lydia and Christine thought of themselves as feminists, but somehow seemed to live inside marriages whose pattern was very like their mother's. That doesn't close down on anything. And it's not an aha moment. It's just one of the many observations that I think for a long time I did think that you had to have made up your mind about everything to write properly. And I had a terrible feeling that I hadn't made up my mind about anything and probably in a way never would. I'm much too persuadable. I am. I will read a non-fiction book which makes one argument and I will be utterly persuaded, and then I'll read the opposite and I'm utterly persuaded. And I used to think that was a real flaw. I still do think it's a real flaw. It's a good job I'm not an MP or something, isn't it? Oh, I don't know.
Well, I don't know, actually.
We could do with a bit more of that. It's a good thing I'm not a surgeon, let's say. But
maybe we'll grant you that.
Definitely a good thing.
Decisiveness is, yeah.
But actually, I think for writing, that's one way of doing it.
But did that? I mean, we've spoken a bit about this before, and it's been something you've talked about a bit. I mean, you were priming yourself to write for a long time, weren't you? You didn't write. And then, of course, it feels like this to us. Then there is this flood of these wonderful books. And it probably doesn't feel quite the same to you. But
it does feel a bit flood-like. I should probably slow down. But there you are now. I have to get it done quick before I can't do it anymore.
I wasn't
priming myself, as you beautifully say, to write. I was writing extremely bad books, which then didn't, thank God, get published and are all thrown away. But I was trying to, and I think I was trying to have all those made up mind. I was faking.
That was the
made
issue,
up mind.
That was the crux.
I haven't put it like that to myself before, but as I'm saying it, it sounds plausible for a moment. Anyway, I'll change my mind later. Yeah, that was a part of the issue. I thought I was loving Brecht and Nadine Gordimer, and I wanted to write with that something of that certainty, though, of course, Gordimer is actually subtle psychological realist. So,
but you had sort of, as it were, persuaded yourself that conviction was the kind of route to writing sort of fully realised fiction. What changed then?
I don't quite know. Some watershed moment that was probably a combination of lots of things, but accepting the smallness, accepting the tentativeness, I think, but quite what enabled me to accept it at a given moment and realise that was exactly what I had to say, it happened. I mean, I went on a writing course.
Yes.
That helped. Not because anyone can teach you to write, but because you're suddenly writing for actual people instead of some theoretical audience.
It was a sort of permission.
It was a sort of
That you gave yourself.
Yeah.
To sort of be open about what you were doing.
And maybe not just that I gave myself. Maybe somehow, strangely, people gave me.
Yeah, yes. And when you started, I mean, it was, as you still write all the time, short stories. Your first book was a kind of linked, sort of linked short stories, Accidents in the Home, was sort of.
You've
been very interested in the kind of interplay between these two forms, haven't you?
I sort of felt a breakthrough and that I could write something that felt like a short story. It had that sprung tension in it and it was whole and it held on the page. But I had no idea how to build a novel, which seemed to me such a long, long piece of engineering. How do you know when you start at this end, how you're going to bring it down at the other, and how do you sustain that sloppy bit in the middle? So I just wrote lots of those short story-shaped pieces about the same people in chronological order in my first novel and my second novel and my fourth novel, sort of, and my fifth novel. And in the past, my last novel, I feel as if I have the bridge engineering for the first time, which is very exciting. I feel I can do a novel now. For what it's worth, whatever it is, the novels are, I have the sense of how to build it.
And you didn't have that before. That amazes me when I think about your novel, Everything Will Be All Right.
But that's quite episodic. It's very episodic.
Well, I know, but it's not...
No, I know. It's different, though. It's different.
I'd say it had the engineering.
Okay.
You know, I would.
Okay.
I'm sucking up, but it is what I actually think.
Very happy with that.
But think about that. I mean, that was really, a decade ago that you wrote that book?
More.
Yeah. But thinking about the past, which I'm sure lots of people here have read it. I mean, again, a wonderful novel. As its title suggests, it does go back into the past at various points, sort of. And occasionally, explosively.
Just once.
Yeah,
just once.
Just the once.
In the middle section.
You did a very... I mean, that was people in a space that wasn't their own exactly.
Yeah.
For a very short period of
Quite
time.
Quite theatrical, again.
I mean, it could have been a play in a sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it was...
Could have been.
It had that kind of play-like thing. Do you like to set yourself these kind of different challenges?
I think it's more a matter that as you're doing the one thing, you have an urge to do the other thing. So I conceived of the past, which is all or was originally just going to be in that 3 weeks in a house in the country when I was writing Clever Girl, an episodic novel that covers 50 years of a woman's life. And I wanted to do the opposite.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
to have lots of room to let them converse together and talk together. And so I did, although that produced its own problems and there was a slackness in the middle. So that's when I, as I was writing, decided to drop back into the 30 years ago and put that middle section in. And I think as I was writing the past with its concentration, I conceived the desire to do another, as it were, one with a long span.
So it is this sort of feeling...
slight reaction to what the last thing was.
This feeling that, okay, the architecture, you've got a sense of this architecture that is exciting and interesting to kind of play with now. I wonder if I could ask you a little bit about love, which there is in this book, lots of. But my goodness, people don't always have a great time being in love in your books. They don't have the worst time either. It's not kind of Anna Karenina. You'll be glad to hear. But it is...
I'm a bit disappointed.
Oh, God! It's like a sort of exquisite torture. I keep disappointing you. But you know what I mean.
Of course I do.
You know what I mean.
Yes. It's true. I think I'm not very romantic. There is lots and lots of love in the book. Lots of it.
Yeah.
Of the companionable kind, the friendship kind, the parental kind, the filial kind. But romantic love, I have Lydia, and I like Lydia. She's quite bad and heedless, but she believes in it. And in the end, I don't want to say too much, but I think in the end, Lydia not only sort of gets what she wanted, but it's real. It's real. If you believe in it, it makes it so. And Christine is hopelessly probably, she isn't me, but she probably shares my rather feeble capacity for romanticness, which has nothing to do with not loving.
Or do you mean sort of drama? Do you mean dramatic
I
love?
I mean Red Roses. You know, that stuff. And Valentine's Day and declaring that you can't live without somebody.
Yeah.
That stuff. Do you know
what
I mean?
Yes, I do know what you mean. And I think the thing is, if you read a lot of novels, that kind of gets knocked out of you. And probably that's just as true if you write them as well as reading them.
I think if you live quite a lot of life, it can get knocked out of you, unless it's just in you. And if you have it in you, then you probably make it be so.
Lydia is just as old as the rest of them.
And she has, and somewhere Alex says to her, when Lydia talks about having loved one person all her life long, he says, that is an act of will. You have willed it to be so. And she says, how does anybody else live? So I give that possible, there are just that many shades of people. And it's all true when you think it's true.
Before we get some questions from the audience, I'm going to ask you, I suppose a little bit about the title, but what it betokens. This idea of the kind of later acts of life, the bit where you're actually supposed to be set in your stone, you're supposed to be in your space with your partner in one way or another. The characters in this book, partly as a result of this trauma, actually cast off that notion in a way, don't they? And they behave, you know, as it were, like people much younger than them.
But always, I hope, with a consciousness of time's winged chariot behind them.
So the writer writing about, I mean, we can look at your books and see you writing about different times in people's lives. What was it like to write about this kind of sort of middle age with just the hint of after middle age coming across the horizon?
I just felt, it sort of felt truthful. I mean, my the evidence of my eyes is that actually all the drama doesn't stop when you reach 40. On the whole, people don't settle down into slippers and retirement home. They just, stuff goes on happening. Stuff happens to people. I've always loved that. For the purposes of story, maybe for the purposes of life as well, but certainly for novels, amazing things happen which force you out of your familiar pattern and your comfort zone. And of course, that's what one can write about.
There are, actually, now I think of it, smaller characters. There are two absolutely fantastic mothers-in-law in this book. Both the mothers-in-law, in completely different ways, and very, very different people, are kind of terrific. Were they those these minor characters that you
they're fun? I'm glad you like them. Yeah, they were fun. I mean, my Czech mother-in-law, I sort of, for a while, I wanted to, I think Isabel, the granddaughter, does call them Czech granny and English granny. But I wanted to make more of that. The Czech one I just made up, but I sort of loved her and thought she was funny and yet believable and real. And I made the other one up as well. She isn't that like my mother, but just a little bit, where she's trying to persuade poor Christine that if only she does her hair differently and wears nicer clothes, she... You know, she might be able to get her man back.
Actually, I've undercounted the mothers-in-law. Then there's the landlady, the pub landlady.
And of course, I'd forgotten. Yes, indeed. So, yes, no, there's some strong older characters, none of whom show any signs, really, of stopping, do they?
No, and not ageing, really, not in that way. Shall we have some questions from the audience? Yes. I love a quick hand.
Yes, but it's coming.
Speedily arriving.
Thank you. I suppose it's a comment and then a question. I really enjoyed the book. I loved the sense of fluidity between the characters, and particularly looking at it from a sense of power play between the characters, and there's power play from the very first page in an almost Jamesian sense, and I'm aware that you've written a critical text on James's later novels. That's the comment. The question is that I'm now rereading it much more slowly and really enjoying the rereading even more. But I did sort of think, perhaps I'll take it as an Audible text. And I listened to the 5-minute clip on Audible from Abigail Thor. I thought, no, it's a literary novel. It's got to be read. But my question is, what do you think of the performance of the text? And perhaps do you have any input as an author?
It's a really good question.
But it slightly catches me unawares in that I don't think I knew it was finished and out there. So I haven't listened.
This is just a question about the Audible version for anybody kind of right at the back who didn't hear, which is read by Abigail Thor.
What they do on the whole is send me 3 or 4, 5 or 6 people who I choose the one that sounds best to me, and I often don't necessarily know those voices. They send me some clips of them reading different things, and I choose one. I think they always go with my choice. I mean, they've obviously pre-selected people who they think would be good. So, I can remember with a past, with another novel, London Train, listening into a bit of one of the audios and being a bit appalled by the extravagant accents. I think when the poor actress has to read all these hours of your book, they sort of entertain themselves by... So anyone I'd mentioned came from Birmingham was sort of talking like, you know, in a thick Brummie accent. And anyone I'd mentioned from Yorkshire, even if they were a lecturer in French, was sort of speaking... So that slightly disconcerted me. And the truth is that I feel funny about it. I am delighted for it to be done. I can't think of anything more wonderful. And one's... You know, I love it that people are listening to so many books and listening in the car and listening on their headphones and everything. So I'm wholly for it. But because I've written the words, I know how I want the sentence to be inflected. And actually, it's happened to me even, there's something they did in America where I was talking about the book. And they have an actress. She was super, she was brilliant. But it was still, I kept thinking, oh, no, not like that. Because I've got it inside my head how it should sound. But I don't think that's very relevant to the end result. That's just me because I wrote it.
Do you listen to other books? But you're not an audio listener.
I'm not, actually.
No.
But I love it that it's there so that if ever I can't read Horror of Horrors, then I can listen.
It doesn't somehow go into your brain in the same way, of course,
but
does
I think
it?
One
I
mean, could it is a different brain. Thing. One could train yeah. one's brain. I know you could. Mm.
And you've never been tempted to read your own audio?
They've never asked me. It would be quite a long haul, wouldn't it?
I think I believe it takes it some take. A long time, yeah. I think. But, yeah. you know, some writers yeah. do.
I do love to. I love to read, so maybe I should suggest myself. I don't know. I'm wary
actually, you,
of that.
I mean, you have read, when I think about it, you have read.
I read
because
the short
you read
stories.
The short stories for the New Yorker podcast.
Whenever there's a short story yeah. in the New Yorker now, they want you to read it and put it on a podcast. So I do. I read the stories very happily.
I saw Tessa at something a while ago, and I said, God, I went to sleep listening to you last night. And it was a really disconcerting thing to say, and I don't know why
no
I said it.
But I did. I wasn't offended.
Good.
I like the thought of it.
Let's have a, yes, so just halfway down, and then there's somebody right at the back. We'll come to you after. We'll make our
Thank
way
you
down,
so much.
Ladies.
I think your writing is absolutely exquisite. And when I read you, I think of great female writers of the past, like Iris Murdoch, Elizabeth Bowen, Elizabeth Taylor, who's kind of sticking out of the bookshelf over there. But you know, your writing is so influenced by, you know, by the past. Couldn't you give us your three kind of most formative female writers?
It would be undoubtedly Elizabeth Bowen, who is probably... Nobody has a favourite writer. It would be ridiculous to have a favourite writer, and how could it not be Tolstoy or Chekhov or somebody? But maybe it is Elizabeth Bowen. Do you know, I'm going to say something so ridiculous. I think Elizabeth Bowen is every bit as great as Henry James, and I love Henry James. And I really have been testing that thought, because it's a sort of forbidden thing to say. But I think it's real. Oh, there are things she doesn't do that James does, but there are things he doesn't do that she does. So I love Elizabeth Bowen. At the moment, I'm loving Mavis Gallant, the wonderful Canadian short story writer. I find, is like a pure adrenaline shot in the veins. It's marvellous stuff. So, so unsoppy. It's like, just in case you were tempted for one moment, she in a tiny story that is in one sense exquisitely lyrical can sum up the entire politics of post-war Europe in the 1950s, and yet it's just a tiny story about a Canadian no-good drifter working for the UN. How can she do that? So she's a superb writer. Oh, three. I don't know where. It would have to be Alice Munro, who was a sort of gateway. She was the writer. She was the writer I read and thought, I see. You can take this small thing, and it's big. She was. I loved and still loved Gordimer, but that wasn't useful to me. That's one has a funny sort of relation. You know, there are some writers who are useful. They are much, much more than that, of course, and one's love of their books comes first, but also they help you to write. And she was the first. But actually, she's got a marvellous loose weave to her sentences that are nothing like what I do. My sentences sound a little bit more like Bowen's, but in saying that, I blush because I was just reading her today. I have her often beside me while I write, and I was just reading this short story and some of the things in those sentences that one can't even remember afterwards, and yet they're sublimely good.
The mention of Iris Murdoch there.
Yeah, I'm not a mad fan you're not, of Iris Murdoch. It hasn't ever done it for me.
This might be your most Murdoch-y book in a way.
So people tell
but
me.
Less
I
mad,
just read
less
some
bonkers.
More. Okay.
Yeah, less
I've never got on
really,
with it. I
know.
Don't like it.
Okay.
I love the Margaret Drabble. The Millstone is a beautiful little book. Perhaps that's my favourite of hers. But lots and lots of her. She's marvellous.
Thank you. We had a question just there. Thank you.
I've only named women. That wasn't a sort of feminist point. Of course, there are loads of men who's... I love John Updike.
You talked about Henry James a little bit.
And I did. But only to put him down. No, not to put him down at all, but to elevate Elizabeth Bowen and say, I thought she was as good.
Hi. Thanks very much for the book. I thought it was great. I was just wondering, you mentioned your notebooks, and it sort of made me curious about what your writing routine is like, and whether you how many stories you're kind of baking as you're you know, going about your daily life. You know, what time you do your writing, when, how you fit it into your life.
I just write whenever I can, which really means on all the days I'm not doing something else. And there are quite a lot of days when I am doing something else. But when I can, I do it because I love to do it. And I probably write for about between 3 and 4 hours, because that's about the maximum you can sustain it for, I feel. And I write straight onto the computer, really. But I always have a notebook open. And the notebook has a double function. It's become so vain to think anyone would be interested in this, because it's sort of ridiculous. But anyway, as you've asked, I'll tell you. So in the back, there might be plans and ideas for a story or ideas for a novel. That's exactly what I was putting down in there today. But at the front, it's a working book that's open beside the computer. And something really weird goes on. That, like, so I'm stuck for the next bit. And then I'm trying out things. Now, why can't I try them out on the computer? I don't quite know, but it's as if that's a pre-writing place. So there's a lot of scribbled words, sometimes lots of words, trying for the same thing over and over, or lots of phrases trying for the same thing, and then I'm putting it on the computer. But of course I'm not, that isn't then, I'm then playing with that too. And I will also have another file on the computer called Extras, where when I'm taking chunks out, thinking, oh my God, that's horrible, I put it in there in case I change my mind.
Because it doesn't seem so horrible the next day.
It sometimes doesn't.
And are those extras sometimes also things that aren't horrible, but you think, this is a lovely little scene or vignette, but it's not
the
working
The rhythm's
here.
Wrong, it's distracting us. Absolutely, it often is that, actually.
And they just have to...
They just have to go.
They have to go, there was a question right at the back in the...
Hi, I discovered your work on The New Yorker and I fell in love with your stories. I'm focusing on writing short stories myself, and you've been one of the writers that have been useful to me in finding my voice, as well as you said, there's writers that you love, but they're not doing what you would like to do. Whereas you focus on family relationships and making the ordinary extraordinary, like sort of simple everyday life or something like unclogging a drain, and the beauty in that, which I love. I was wondering if you have any advice for a novice writer or someone emerging in their writing, as well as how to go about finding a mentor.
Advice for a novice writer
who's writing short stories. I mean, and finding a mentor, it's probably just the obvious thing, which is to do a good writing course, to go on an MA like I did, because you will find exactly that, if you're lucky, if it works. And it's very good. It's because it's also like a kind of super editing. So you've got an editor who's working with you even as you're finding your way, and it speeds up all the things you would painfully slowly learn by yourself. Having someone say, oh dear, that bit's boring or something is really useful. That bit's boring is a huge revelation. And that used to happen to me when I thought, I'm writing this tonight, and on Thursday, those 7 people are going to read it. And then I would look at it and think, but my God, that's boring and that's pretentious. It was wonderful. Why couldn't I do that when it was just by myself? Isn't that funny? Real people sharpen one's mind. So that's a part of it. And the other thing is, keep reading and keep doing it. That's not very helpful, is it? I don't know that I do. You just have to keep trying and then go on a course. Yes, that was not at all illuminating, but it's probably the truth. There's no single way. One of the things you realise, I teach creative writing. One of the things you realise is that there are no prescriptions. What there is that story there, this is what needs to be done. That novel there, maybe that. There just are not many blanket prescriptions or formulae. There aren't any. There's all kinds of stuff you can be encouraged to think about voice and structure and tone and point of view, which sounds like a technicality, but turns out to be very fundamental. We haven't talked about that at all, but I swap the point of view around between my protagonists, but much more than that, I also avail myself of omniscience quite a lot, and I watch all of them, and I watch them in a way that no one of them could see. I see the four of them together, and that seems to me a resource in narrative that is a really rich one, if you like it, if it's your thing.
And it's also one of those extraordinary techniques, isn't it? Because you don't announce to us, the reader, that you're going to switch from...
No,
you know, now we're going to, and this is me knowing everything. That doesn't... We really don't know. It's like a trick.
What you've got to do, this is something that crops up with students, if you are going to do that, you've got to do it early on. You can't write from one perspective till page 72 and then suddenly shock everybody by becoming omniscient and seeing everybody. It's part of the contract you have to establish quite early on with your book.
Yeah.
Unless you have different sections in which you do it from the perspective of different people, that works.
Then it's all about the formal announcement, isn't it, in a
way?
Then
it is. Yeah. It is. Yeah. Exactly that.
There's a question there, and I know there's one there. We'll take this gentleman first because I think he, oh my goodness.
Hello.
Sorry, hello.
Hi, Tessa. Hi. Really, really enjoyed your book. And something that I've been dying to know, actually, is there struck me as like quite a lack of remorse, I feel, in the book from Christine and Alex. And I think, sorry, I hope I'm not spoiling it for anyone. And for Alex, it made a lot of sense, I think. But for Christine, I was surprised, and I wondered if that was deliberate on your part, that, you know, in talking about this sort of the messiness of life and the messiness of these characters, was that quite deliberate on your part?
It's funny, one of my students, I was in Bath a couple of days ago, said, did you write 50 pages of Christine's agonised remorse and tear them up or something? does that just reveal some terrible moral absence? I feel that it's very difficult to answer you without spoiling the story. I feel stuff happens and it passes and it's almost as if it never happened. I feel that, how you take the things you've done morally. Again, I suppose I'm coming back to that business about romantic love. It's what you make of it. And that what you're referring to could have been the occasion for a lot of agonized conscientiousness. But people are extraordinary and they could just step on to the next day and leave it. And I didn't feel that she felt, she knew it must never be found, but I didn't feel she felt she had offended some profound moral law inside herself. And I'm not a total moral relativist. I'm not saying there isn't a moral law. In the sexual arena, it's a complicated one. And so I have to admit that I just thought she might step on and leave it behind. With a little, you know, she's aware. She has that conversation with Lydia in the concert, which touches it. And another one on the stairs. There are a couple of occasions when we come near something like what she's done with that story. And I think it's partly because when they were young, there was that connection. That changes something. I'm talking very enigmatically and slightly, sort of perhaps it doesn't make any sense to those who haven't read the book yet. Does that kind of answer it? Can you forgive me?
You know, the awful... Now I feel like you've told me a terrible truth about myself, because I heard your question and your answer and thought, well, she didn't do anything wrong. I know.
God.
Yes, sir. I wasn't even thinking.
I'm afraid,
what
yeah.
What are you talking about?
I'm afraid it's another a question vaguely related to judgment, but I think, but also
that's what we're doing tonight.
It's about sort of the way in which you've dealt with different generations, because as well as the four main characters that we've talked about a lot here, you've also got the young Isabel and Grace and Sandy and Blaise, and then you've got the younger versions of the four main characters. Were you sort of very conscious of how they judged each other? You know, even if we're not talking about sexual judgment and so on and so forth. Have your children read these books, and what do they think about them?
my children, some of my children read. I've got three sons, and one of them's very bookish, and he likes my books. My middle one reads one Ian Rankin a year and is deeply suspicious of what might be in my books, fears it, and has probably guessed exactly the thing that the last question was about. And my oldest son is much more a history and politics man. But he said something really funny many years ago. There was some emotional crisis in his life. And he sort of said, I suppose I'd better read one of Mum's books to find out. Yes. I mean, they do, the children in this book are deeply appalled. Well, some of them, two of them, Isabel and Sandy, are deeply appalled by what their parents are getting up to. I rather love Grace, who says, if it makes them happy. And I think those two possibilities are both real. I'm really interested in the generations. And as her mother is sort of telling her that she should, you know, put on more makeup, and Christine's mother telling her and dress up to get her man back. And all of both psychology of different individuals comes into play, but also the anthropology of the generations and what each generation, as it were, believes about couples and sexual identity and sex and marriage. So to me, it's just a sort of very rich terrain for telling stories from.
Claire, you've rushed to the front.
The lady.
Oh, I thought you were pulling us off with a kind of big shepherd's crook.
Oh, the lady in green.
The lady in green.
Sorry. So thank you. I love the book. I'm a big fan of your work. And Elizabeth Bowen, yes, 100%. I have a question, and you may feel inhibited from answering it because it would be like a spoiler, but I was very interested that you picked up at the beginning of your discussion about the studio and locking it up. And I love the way that there's no big explanation about why that should be. There's no big cause and effect. It's just something that she does. But I wondered if, as you also revealed that you wrote that, what we read is pretty much what you set down initially. So did you have a resolution to that in your mind fixed that early on?
Yes.
Because I
did. I don't always have the... I knew that once you, at the beginning of a book, have somebody turning a key on a room and shutting it up and putting the key in their pocket, you have... That's one of the pieces of engineering that makes a novel, and that... you're going to do something with that key. Finally, I mean, she could drop it down a drain in the street and go and be a nurse or something else.
Okay.
So I did know that. But however, actually, the way I wrote the ending is a very interesting example of how messy and flawed novels are, because people can intervene at a late stage with your novel and make it better. I had it ending one way. I actually had it, no difference, by the way, about that thing you've just talked about. But it ended with, how am I going to say this without? It ended domestically with Christine and her daughter together. Not, you know, the actual ingredients, not so very different. And my American publisher said, actually, it's fine, but it's too domestic. Do something better. And she was right. I'm so pleased with my ending as it is now. And that Isn't that interesting? That didn't, I mean, it came from me. I solved it. I found the new thing. But that was her push.
Yeah. Well, now we've talked about the ending. Perhaps it's, I want to say, first of all, when I said I didn't like the characters.
Oh, no, Alex, I'm going back. Don't mind. No,
I think I like not liking things.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? We know what we mean. Also, can I just say something about the frittata? The reason I remember...
I make a really good frittata. I bet you never thought about it as a very posh food.
No, it wasn't that it was posh. It was that who would have the kind of wherewithal in a crisis to think, I'm going to make a frittata. But the reason easiest. I remember it...
Yes.
It's easy, but you know what I mean.
You know, I have to tell you something about Alex. She isn't a very good cook. I've never eaten your food, but you told me the story of your Christmas cake once.
That's different. Not being able to make a Christmas cake is really...
All right,
I don't
so maybe
think.
You are a good cook. Are you?
Not for me to say.
So she doesn't know that a frittata is a common or
no,
garden
I do.
Thing.
The thing that I remember about the frittata, I'm saying, this is why it's stuck in my mind, is that the character, in great emotional distress and anxiety, makes a frittata and then sprinkles salt on it. And it's
and
the
lemon
salt
juice. Lemon, and lemon juice and salt
that makes
I
remember.
It so much better. In defense of my character, she makes the frittata at a very early stage, before she's in any distress and anxiety.
Oh,
she's
God,
just waiting for him to come back.
In my version,
yeah,
she's,
no,
you know,
she makes
beating
it
furiously.
Calmly and cheerfully, and the angst develops post-frittata.
I'm very, very grateful to the London Review of Books audience, by the way, for handling in a way that would never happen on, say, you know, social media, obviously, the business of spoilers. Because they've just been so, you would have been so delicate. That thing that happens
that thing
when somebody, etc., and then they might not like the other person. You've been marvellous, but I've sensed just this incredible engagement with Tessa's work, which is as it should be. Tessa, as ever, a complete joy to talk to you. Thank you so, so much. Thank you, Claire, for having us here.
Thank you, Claire.
And
thank you,
everybody
Alex.
At
thank
the
you,
LLB.
Tessa.
Bookshop, and you're going to sign now, but you're going to tell me what to do, aren't you?
No, I literally want to thank you all for coming, for your comments, contributions and questions, and most of all ask you to help me thank Alex Clark and Tessa Hadley. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.